makes people like Martyr Soleimani stand out.
According to the participants of the conference, Martyr Soleimani had a deep understanding of politics and based his views on the guidelines of the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. They say this is the most important reason why he should always be remembered.
It is our national duty to keep the memory of Martyr Soleimani alive. He is a role model for future generations, and we need to elaborate on his school of thought for the next generation to walk down the same path.
My husband is in prison in our country, the Republic of Azerbaijan, since 2011, when he was sentenced to 12 years in prison for protesting against the ban on hijab. He was inspired by Martyr Soleimani. It is very important to introduce Martyr Soleimani to the world and the younger generation.
The plight of the Palestinians was another topic high on the agenda.
This conference is of great importance because one of the major goals of Martyr Soleimani was to liberate Palestine, and this is also one of the major issues that was pointed out in the panel discussion. It has also been mentioned in the final statement of the conference.
Eight panels separately focused on different dimensions of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought, from his personal life to his teachings and great leadership skills. However, his views regarding international politics received more attention.
I think we can highlight three points. One deals with the role that General Soleimani had in stopping U.S. hegemonic designs for the Middle East. The second point was his ability to organize people, to create networks of like-minded people. He was a religious man, he was an ethical man. He was someone that attracted people, and that was one of the reasons that he was successful.
While the organizers of the conference have decided to set up a permanent secretariat, they say they are open to receiving more research papers, projects, and books for the next conference, which will be focusing more on the legacy of a man who is known for making great efforts in eradicating insecurity in the region.
Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani fought for peace, security, and stability in the region. According to the participants of this conference, his greatest legacy and achievement was eliminating Daesh terrorists. Gisu Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Historic electoral breakdowns in the United States continue to multiply. For the first time in 100 years, Congress has failed to immediately elect a speaker for the House of Representatives, which is the nation's number three post following the vice president. After 2 days and more than a handful of votes, a group of around 20 so-called Trumpist lawmakers continue to reject the mainstream Republican, Kevin McCarthy. An irony is that Donald Trump urged Republicans to unite behind McCarthy, a reflection of the deep divisions in a politically reconfigured nation.
It's kind of the Republican establishment not knowing how to deal with the monster that both the corporate and right-wing media systems have kind of created over the last kind of period, the emergence of Trump as a political figure and then the rise of Trumpism. It's really kind of gotten away from at least the establishment Republicans that would very much like to be able to wash their hands of January 6th, and can't.
The failure to choose a speaker reduces Congress' total standstill, with legislation impossible. The only legal solution is for someone to finally win a majority. In 1855, that took 2 months and 133 rounds of voting. The Republican red wave of 2022 only produced such a narrow midterm victory that even a small group of their lawmakers can exert a huge amount of influence. The hardline stance of the dissenting Republicans is actually what many Democrat supporters expected out of the so-called squad of alleged progressives after their party's even narrower blue wave win in 2020.
Very much kind of putting to shame the squad and showing that being a unified bloc, even if you're a minority, if you take a fighting stance and you don't go along to get along, you can fight for meaningful wins. Unfortunately, now we have an example from the right.
The caucus of dissenters is often described as far right, while others note that their nominee for speaker is an African American and that their demands include more transparency in legislation and less power for congressional leaders. Many expected that a divided Congress would produce squabbles and political stagnation, but perhaps not this quickly. The electoral dysfunction at the federal level continues to embarrass and perhaps discredit democracy with American characteristics. Amin Mazahari, Chicago.
While the world celebrates the start of a new year with festivities and a display of fireworks, Yemen ushers in the new year with fireworks from artillery shelling by the Saudi-led coalition. In just the first hours of 2023, Saudi Arabia carried out a series of artillery shelling in northern Yemen close to Saudi borders. According to the reports, at least 18 innocents were injured in the latest attacks. This comes after a year of bloodshed, according to the Humanity Eye Center for Rights and Development. In their latest report for the year 2022, the center revealed statistics of war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition. According to the report, over 3,000 Yemenis were killed and injured in 2022. Humanity Eye Center statistic and research analyst Gais Jamal reports that these crimes occurred near the Saudi border during a ceasefire.
In the year 2022, most of the crimes were committed on residents living in bordering districts with Saudi Arabia, despite the announcement of a ceasefire. The only thing that stopped was the airstrikes. However, Saudi rockets and artillery shelling continued. There was no ceasefire in the districts near the Saudi border. From the first day the ceasefire was announced, the attacks continued until this day.
Saudi Arabia and its coalition also attacked airports, Yemeni ports, and almost 15,000 homes, livestock farms, and communication stations in 2020, according to the report. Humanity Eye says it has all the evidence to prove that Saudi-led coalition committed war crimes on a mass scale.
We have met with French rights groups and presented to them reports with evidence that expose how Saudi Arabia and its allies and European states played a direct role in supporting Saudi Arabia with weapons that were used to commit war crimes on Yemenis. We presented all necessary evidence to this French rights group, and they have filed a case in court against Mohammed bin Salman and bin Zayed for the war crimes committed. This case is currently pending.
The European legal system is unlikely to bring any Saudi or UAE official to justice, which is why Yemenis want justice now.
We are calling on our government to take tough military actions against the aggressors. They are occupying our lands, destroying our homes, and killing us, and we will not remain silent for much longer. We are a free Yemeni nation with a great civilization. We have the right to defend ourselves.
The Yemeni people are suffering from the blockade and the oppression being spearheaded by Saudi Arabia. Therefore, we call on the Yemeni government to take decisive actions now to lift the blockade and end the suffering of the people.
As the conflict enters a new year, tensions are steadily rising on all active battlefronts in Yemen between Saudi-led forces and the Yemeni army. If a peaceful resolution is not reached soon, an all-out war is likely to ensue.
Pressure is beginning to mount on the Yemeni government to end the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition as millions of Yemenis continue to suffer. Yemenis we spoke with are calling on the Ansar Allah movement to end the siege now by any means necessary. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
The start of the new year has brought bad news for the Italians. The average price of unleaded petrol at the pump in Italy has once again surged, increasing by over 15 cents. That is about 15% more compared to December 31st. The latest hike is due to the expiration of measures introduced in May to mitigate the nefarious effects on Italy's economy of an exceptionally high increase in the cost of energy that followed the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict. The price of unleaded petrol stands now at about 1.8 euros per litre, while that of diesel has reached almost 2 euros.
The increase in fuel costs at the turn of the new year is mainly due to the reinstatement of the full rates of excise duty and VAT on petrol, diesel and LPG that the former government led by Mario Draghi introduced last year. The spike is also due to the higher cost of mixing biofuels with petrol and diesel as required by the law.
Experts fear fuel prices might even increase further after February the 5th, when a European Union ban on Russian oil product imports kicks in as part of sanctions against Moscow over the war in Ukraine. This follows a ban on Russian crude that took effect in December.
With a population of 59 million and about 40 million circulating vehicles, it is easy to understand how vital is the role of road transport in Italy. It accounts for three-quarters of all land transportation of goods. It goes without saying that the country's rising fuel costs for both petrol and diesel will have dreadful consequences for medium and small businesses and for everyday people.
While wages remain the same, fuel in general, energy costs keep rising. I'm very worried. Too much uncertainty.
What worries me the most is the fact that wages remain unchanged while the cost of living is skyrocketing. I have four kids and we are struggling to make ends meet.
Higher fuel prices further swell living costs for people in Italy as electricity and gas bills have increased by about 300% since September. Italy was expecting to raise almost 10 billion euros from measures targeting the super profits made by energy companies that benefited from the surge in oil and gas prices. So far, only one quarter of that amount has been paid to the tax office. Max Civili, Rome.
Three years have passed since the U.S. assassination of top Iranian military commander General Qasem Soleimani, one of the dozens of commemoration ceremonies that have been held across Iran. Senior military and state officials attend a gathering in Tehran to pay their respect to General Soleimani.
Martyr Soleimani was the forerunner of all the martyrs who lost their lives in the fight against terrorism. That's why his name continues to be remembered by Iranians.
Not only did the American authorities committed this crime, but they openly took responsibility for it. We have been following up on our legal pursuit with the cooperation of Iraq's judiciary to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Soleimani was the commander of a branch of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps called the Quds Force, which is in charge of conducting overseas operations. He was killed on January 3, 2020, in a drone strike outside Baghdad International Airport on a direct order from then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Millions took part in his funeral, both in Iraq and Iran. Now, on his third assassination anniversary, Iranians still feel the loss.
It's been 3 years now that we lost our commander. We call him the Commander of Hearts because he fought Daesh overseas to keep the terrorists at bay and prevent them from entering our soil. We owe our security to General Soleimani.
General Soleimani is known for his role in eliminating Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. He also led major operations in Syria that led to the recapturing of key areas from Daesh. That's why his assassination is viewed as a huge loss for the region and a big win for the terrorists.
People here say General Soleimani's assassination gave a clear clue about who is who in the fight against terrorism in the region. They say the U.S. killed the nemesis of Daesh, and that corroborates Trump's claim that America created Daesh. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willest, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee. The facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The new extreme right-wing Israeli cabinet has started its work with some controversial and provocative moves, although it has assumed power for only about a week. The visit by the hardliner minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Al-Aqsa Mosque earlier this week drew widespread condemnations from not only the Muslim world, but even the U.S. The same minister has visited Nafa prison today to make sure the conditions of the inmates have not improved and that they don't have, quote, excessive rights, a move that Hamas has slammed as an unprecedented criminal act. The Tel Aviv regime has also issued financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority. We'll discuss these issues in tonight's Spotlight program with our guests. Kevin Barrett, editor of Veterans Today, joining us from Madison. And also Lebanese journalist Sandos Al-Assad joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, it's great to have you with us. Let's start off with Mr. Barrett in Madison. The United Nations Security Council has voiced concern about the status quo of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound following this provocative visit by the Israeli minister. That's just more platitudes and no action. Why did the Security Council yet again fail to act against another Israeli violation?
Well, the UN Security Council has been running interference for the Zionists for quite some time. Even though the Zionists are the biggest international outlaws and criminals, the violators of the most UN resolutions of any country on earth, they're still given a pass. And probably a lot of the reason for that is that they have so much power in several of the countries that make up the Security Council. So we shouldn't expect the United Nations to solve this problem, certainly not the Security Council as it's currently structured. If it were changed and restructured and became more reflective of the world's population, then that might change. But as it stands right now, this most extreme Israeli government in history, with people like Ben-Gavir, who basically worships Baruch Goldstein, the perpetrator of the Hebron massacre, a serial killer and maniac, and Ben-Gavir used to have a big picture of him on his wall, that he bowed to, I guess. This guy is a complete, you know, there's really nobody. There's no genocidal maniac on earth today that you could find that could really beat this guy in the sweepstakes for that title. He's now taking up where a long list of other Zionist extremists have left off in terms of provoking violence by attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the oldest and greatest Islamic architectural monument, and trying to set the stage ultimately for demolishing it, as many of these maniacal, ultra-extremist, messianic, millenarian Zionists want to do. So he's taking up where people like Ariel Sharon left off prior to 9/11, when Sharon's job was to set the stage for the post-9/11 crushing of the Palestinians in the run-up to that Israeli demolition of the Twin Towers in New York. So these guys right now in this current government are just completely beyond the pale in terms of anything that even ultra-Zionists like Thomas Friedman of the New York Times can even imagine ever stomaching, and yet the United Nations and the international community are letting them get away with it. And it makes you wonder, what wouldn't they let them get away with?
Ms. Al-Assad, at the United Nations Security Council session, the Palestinian UN envoy said, quote, what red line must be crossed for the Security Council to finally say enough is enough? I think it's safe to say that many of those red lines have already been crossed by the Israelis on numerous occasions.
I believe that the United Nations is complicit in the atrocities that have been held against the Palestinians. The United Nations, we have seen how the United Nations act with double standards policy regarding the issue of Iran, for example, the issue of Russia, the issue of China. They all the time condemn these countries while and sanction them, but they don't sanction the usurping occupation entity. So I don't believe that the United Nations will do justice for the Palestinians. The only thing that will do justice for the Palestinians is the righteous right of resistance. This is the only option that the Palestinians must must uphold, because the Zionists there's no a good Zionist and a bad Zionist. The old Zionists are occupiers, and the Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and to get rid of this occupation.
Kevin Barrett, the Israelis, as we've seen, act with impunity as they are above the law. How has the insufficient international response and lack of action from international bodies such as the UN, the EU, the OIC, and most notably Arab governments contributed to this status quo?
Well, the international institutions are set up to fail. We don't have real international institutions now. What we have is a kind of a set of institutions, starting with the United Nations, that are fig leaves for the protection of power by the powerful. And for that reason, there was never any real intent to have these institutions enforce any kind of just international law. Instead, they provide cover, again, for, like, the U.S. wanted to wage a war in Korea, so they got the United Nations to approve the Korean War, and right on through the Iraq War, these other kinds of interventions. We always see that the United Nations is not representing a majority of the people of the planet. It's essentially just, again, providing cover for the biggest imperial and state interests. So the real question here is not so much why have the international institutions failed. That's what they do. That's what they're designed to do. But rather, why haven't any national governments tried to do something about this? And the national governments that we would expect to stand up for the Palestinians would be the regional governments, the Arab countries, the Palestinians or their fellow Arabs, and of course the Muslim world, and to some extent one would expect the Christian world as well to not particularly appreciate the way the Zionists are committing genocide against Christians in the traditional home of Christianity. But none of those governments, with a very few exceptions, the Islamic Republic of Iran is one of them, have been doing anything to try to stand up for the Palestinians. And they mostly have, in the past, pretended to be, you know, they give lip service, and every now and then one of them has actually helped out the Palestinians. Saddam Hussein did that in Iraq. Muammar Gaddafi did that in Libya. and then they paid the price. And I think the other leaders in the region sort of got the message that the Zionist-controlled West is going to come in and make your life miserable unless you dance to their tune. And so the people of the region, as we saw in the World Cup, are completely opposed to Zionism and virtually unanimous in their ardent desire for the liberation of Palestine. But most of the leaders in the region are not in line with that because they find it's more in their interest to play ball with the world's biggest powers. And what will make that change, I don't know. Maybe as the Palestinian the Palestinian resistance becomes more popular worldwide, including here in the West, even in the Jewish communities of the West, the younger people tend to be more sympathetic to Palestinians. And as the people in the region put pressure on their governments, maybe that will bring some change.
Ms. al-Assad, what do you see behind this latest wave of Israeli aggression and provocations, especially the recent storming of Al-Aqsa by the far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir? Why now?
Because, unfortunately, the rulers, the so-called Muslim rulers, are complicit in these aggressions that are being taken in Al-Aqsa Mosque, desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing the Palestinians. Four Palestinian children have been killed since the onset of this new year. We saw that the Arab monarchs, the Persian Gulf monarchs, are normalizing ties with the Zionists, shamefully normalizing ties with this occupation, and doing nothing to the Palestinians. They said that the so-called Abraham Accords will bring peace and justice for the Palestinians. We haven't seen this justice. The only thing, as I have mentioned earlier, that will bring justice for the Palestinians is the armed resistance. The armed resistance is the key for freeing the Palestinians and supporting them. And as we are marking in these days the martyrdom of Hashqasem Soleimani has done what the Palestinians deserve and what do better for the Palestinians, which is supporting the armed resistance and helping those resistance factions. And this what happened in the recent years. We have seen that while the Arab governments and monarchs have moved into normalization, the Palestinian units are getting closer to each other and uniting their efforts against this aggression. And I believe that the more the aggressive the Zionists will be, the more our resistance will unite and will bring this illegitimate entity into its immediate and eventual collapse.
Kevin Barrett, our Ramallah correspondent, has said to us many times that Israel is planning to split up Al-Aqsa Mosque in terms of space and time, and that any attempt to change the mosque status quo will explode the existing tensions. How important is it for the status quo of Al-Aqsa to remain intact, and what repercussions would there be if that's not the case?
Well, that's right. There's been a kind of a tenuous peace. I guess peace isn't maybe quite the right word for it, given the ongoing slow-motion genocide of Palestine. But we haven't seen a kind of third world war along religious lines break out, in part because the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which again is the Islamic world's oldest and greatest architectural monument and the spiritual symbol of the universality of the Islamic message, as the symbol of the Miraj of the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, who encountered all of the other prophets, including the founding prophets of Christianity and Judaism, as he ascended into the nearness of God. That great symbol and that great monument means everything to the Muslims. And the Zionists, they have a kind of a millenarian messianic mythology that spun off into outright Satanism with Shabtai Zvi in 1666. And those Satanists who have spun off from Judaism and Zionism are dedicated to bringing their false Messiah, their Dajjal or Antichrist, to rule the world. by destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and building a blood sacrifice temple from which the world will be ruled. This is this bizarre millenarian messianic mythology that the ultra-Zionists, and perhaps including Ben-Gavir and his friends, believe in. So keeping the inviolability of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is absolutely paramount in terms of preventing massive global bloodshed if the Zionists do decide to either try to destroy or to take over a portion of this mosque, which Ben-Gavir has announced his intention to do. It's a huge issue, and this is the kind of issue that at least should be talked about honestly in the United Nations, but it hasn't been, and the world's biggest powers have every reason not to want some kind of huge explosion there that could destabilize the world and interfere with their own interests even. Have been slow to talk about this and to try to find a solution to it, because the Zionists, again, they have so much power, and for the Zionists, that control the Western media, that dominate Western finance, even though most of them are not Ben-Gavirs themselves, are not that fanatically attached to destroying the Al-Aqsa Mosque and putting up a blood sacrifice temple to usher in the reign of the Antichrist. A few of them probably are, but most of them aren't. But they still have this mentality that Jewish interests can do no wrong. And so they won't let the Western governments do anything about this.
Ms. Asa, let's talk about the actions of the new extremist Israeli cabinet at just a weekend. To name one instance, there was a visit by the fascist minister Itamar Ben-Gavir to Nafa prison with the aim of harassing the Palestinian prisoners there. Hamas has, of course, responded to that. It's called this an unprecedented criminal act, adding that the extremist occupation government is planning a dangerous escalation that our people will not let it go unnoticed. Are the Israelis, with this new far-right cabinet at its helm, in search of escalating tensions, in your opinion?
I believe that this reckless actions, unfortunately, the Zionists don't learn lessons from their previous experiences. We have seen what happened last summer, last May, during Saif al-Aqsa operations. Unfortunately, they don't learn lessons that as long as they insist in desecrating our holy places and killing our people and murdering our people, their option to resistance became more substantial and more and it's the only key to put an end for these aggressions. I believe that the Muslim population across the globe, especially here in West Asia, must pressure their governments. They must use the alternative media to expose these violations, and to work hard to support the Palestinians, and also the Palestinians must unite, must exert all the possible efforts in order to put an end for these aggressions. I don't believe that the Zionists. I believe that the Zionists take these measures in order to risk to provocate the Palestinians, but the Palestinians will respond, and this is their right to respond and to resist these aggressions.
Kevin Barrett, the office of the new Israeli Prime Minister has just announced financial and political sanctions against the Palestinian Authority in response to their appeal at the International Court of Justice. The regime will also impose a moratorium on some Palestinian construction as well. What are the Israelis trying to achieve with these actions?
Well, they're trying to punish the Palestinian Authority for, in this case, doing the right thing, going to the International Criminal Court, Court of Justice, and trying to get some justice for some of these crimes that have been committed against them. And, of course, the old saying is no good deed goes unpunished. And so the Zionists are punishing the Palestinian Authority for doing something right. And, of course, the Palestinian Authority has done wrong things as well, and it has made too many accommodations with Zionist power. The Zionists think they own the Palestinian Authority, and to some extent they have. They've had a lot of influence over it in the past, at certain points at least. But now I guess they're trying to rein it in, and they're saying, well, if you give in to popular opinion and press these war crimes charges against us, then we will do what we can to make your life more difficult. So that's the sort of thing the Zionists always do. They're always finding ways to retaliate against anyone that's either done something to them or that they imagine has done something to them. And so this actually, it could be a good thing if the Palestinian leaders realize that it's time to stop dealing with the Zionists. Alan Hart, the former BBC lead correspondent for the for Israel-Palestine, personal friend of Yasser Arafat, Golda Meir, used to say in the last years of his life that the Palestinian Authority really should dissolve itself, and that would make the Israeli occupier 100% responsible for everything happening in the occupied territories, and that would put the ball in the next court. And maybe it's time for the Palestinians to do that. But in any case, this will force the PA closer to the views of the majority of their people.
And Ms. al-Assad, Hamas has pledged to defend al-Aqsa at any price. Islamic Jihad has said Israel is responsible for the repercussions of its actions. The PA has said before that any aggression against al-Aqsa is equivalent to crossing all red lines. Now, Russia's UN envoy in the recent Security Council session recounted the events that took place back in the year 2000 after Ariel Sharon stormed al-Aqsa, sparking the second Palestinian intifada. Analysts and observers say we could be looking at the prelude for a third intifada. How do you see it?
The entire axis of resistance has actually warned against another intifada, because as we have mentioned that the Zionist occupation is manifesting on a daily basis its aggressive hostilities against the Palestinians, against our holy places, murdering Palestinians, Palestinian minors, women, and with full impunity, because the Zionist occupation knows that no one will hold them accountable. And as we see that as I've mentioned, that the Persian Gulf monarchies are turning deaf ears and blind eyes to these aggressions and getting closer to the Zionist enemy. And we see that Ansarullah has warned against the aggressive policies of Zionist enemy, also Hezbollah in Lebanon. We witness the aggressions on daily basis that are targeting Syria, also the Judaization of Manama in Bahrain. All of these movements that are taking place by the Zionist enemy will lead eventually, yes, to another intifada, and perhaps it's time that we will witness the collapse of this temporary Zionist occupation in our West Asia region.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Allow me to thank my guests, editor at Veterans Today, Kevin Barra, joining us from Madison, and Lebanese journalist Sandos al-Assad, joining us from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And a special thanks to you all for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., a 6-year-old student has been taken into custody after allegedly shooting his female teacher at Richneck Elementary School in Virginia. The student's identity has not been publicly released and the teacher is said to be in a critical condition. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Daily Mail has covered the story and tells us more. A 6-year-old boy has been taken into police custody after he allegedly deliberately shot his first grade teacher at his Virginia elementary school, leaving her critically ill. Newport News police have taken a student who has not been publicly identified into custody. The unidentified female teacher, who is said to be in her 30s, was reportedly shot in the stomach and has been taken to Riverside Regional Medical Center in Virginia. The individual is a 6-year-old student and is right now in police custody, Newport News Chief Scott Drew said at a press conference on Friday, 6th of January. This was not an accidental shooting, Scott Drew said. It was in a classroom, an altercation took place there, he said. We did not have a situation where someone was going around the school shooting. We had a situation in one particular location where a gunshot was fired. The incident unfolded at Richneck Elementary School, a school for kids aged 5 to 9, just before 2 p.m. on Friday, 6th of January. No children were harmed and police are working to figure out how the child had access to the gun. A grandmother of one of the students told the Daily Mail that a student brought shiny gold bullets to school last week, but it is unclear if it's the same child who was taken into police custody today. The grandmother, who asked not to be named, said the child had allegedly brought bullets to school last week and said he would bring his gun. A parent told the school they did nothing. Now look, she wrote on Facebook. Speaking to the Daily Mail, she said, the parents outside stated that their child told them a kid brought golden shiny bullets to school and was thinking about bringing his gun. The student told the parent, who informed the school. And the school just yesterday got back to the parent saying the parent of the kid said it was a Nerf bullet, and the parent said Nerf bullets aren't shiny and they aren't gold. She was not positive if the child who brought the bullets is the same child allegedly involved in the shooting incident on Friday. The school, however, does have the capability of metal detecting students, Superintendent George Parker said at a press conference. They do not perform the test on every student every day, but said every school in the district has the capability to do so. When we have a perceived threat or issue, we do random metal detection on those days, Superintendent George Parker said on Friday, 6th of January. It is unclear if the school had enhanced testing after a bullet claim the week prior. Today, our students got a lesson in gun violence, Superintendent George Parker said. We need to keep the guns out of the hands of our young people. A British parent of one of the students who is currently based in the United States, as her husband is in the military, is now demanding the town do something about the gun problem. Guns, that's the biggest problem in this country, she told WTKR. Why is there a seven-year-old boy with a gun? How does a seven-year-old have a gun? I'm only here because my husband is in the military, otherwise I would not have chosen to come to this country. Superintendent George Parker said the school would be closed on Monday, 9th of January, to work on the mental health of our staff and students. The Australian Associated Press has also covered the same story and tells us more. A six-year-old boy allegedly shot and wounded a teacher at Richneck Elementary School in Newport News, Virginia, United States, prompting consternation from local officials who vowed to find answers and prevent such an event from happening again. The injury to a teacher, a woman in her 30s, was considered life-threatening, although she had shown some improvement in her health in hospital, Police Chief Steve Drew told reporters. There was no further explanation of how the six-year-old boy had acquired the handgun. Police described it as an altercation in the first-grade classroom that resulted in one shot being fired. This was not an accidental shooting, Police Chief Steve Drew said. I want to know where that firearm came from. Police Chief Steve Drew said the boy was in police custody. No student was injured in the incident, but they had been moved to a gymnasium for their safety and counsellors have been made available, he said. They are safe, they are interacting with officers and having some fun, snapping some high fives and teasing each other, Drew said. Students were reunited with their parents under a school escort. Right now, it's still raw, but what I will tell you is there's going to be a full after-action report, not only internally from the City Council with the school board and others, but we're going to ensure that we have the right steps and policies so that this doesn't happen again, Newport News Mayor Philip Jones told reporters. In the same news conference, School Superintendent George Parker lamented educators' inability to keep guns out of schools, saying he was shocked and disheartened by the incident. We need to keep guns out of the hands of our young people, Superintendent George Parker said. I cannot control access to weapons. My teachers cannot control access to weapons. Superintendent George Parker said all school campuses are equipped for random metal detector searches, but they were not deployed at Richneck Elementary School on Friday, 6th of January 2023.
IRIB English Radio.